Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2019. And I'm now here with Garrod Murphy, who is an Irish nationalist. So, Garrod, welcome to Millennial. And please take it away. Introduce yourself to the audience.
Thanks for having me on. Anybody who doesn't know who I am, which I suspect is quite a few, if they're not Irish anyway, I think many of the Irish nationalists will be aware of me because we're a small enough group. But I do journalism / activism in Ireland related to nationalism in Ireland, related to immigration, issues around this kind of stuff, the kind of issues most people watching are into themselves. And I try to focus on Ireland specifically. You know, I more or less avoid getting caught up in the international scene as much as I can and just focus on what I can do in Ireland to advance the situation here specifically without getting overly ideological, trying to, you know, some of the stuff I do is just try to make bite-sized, they're very long, but videos breaking down why we are becoming a minority in Ireland by 2050, around then, and explaining it from the ground up. Because very often, let's say you make that argument to people and these journalists and technocrats and academics will just dismiss it out of hand and put in these false kind of retorts. And I just make little videos on that to try to empower. I hate when people like us use the word ordinary people, but you know what I mean. People who aren't political or into this stuff. Try to empower people with the language and the rhetoric that they need and the facts that they need, facts and logic, to defend themselves. Because I think there are a lot of, again, ordinary people who understand what's going on in Ireland and abroad, of course, as well. But they maybe they don't spend as much time as we do on this stuff. So instead of getting lost in, you know, high ideology, which is good, I like, because I watch people that do that. I try to keep it a little bit, try to empower people to get them out to, because we can't do it ourselves. That's the way I see it. Us kind of activists and journalists and online people, we're not going to do this by ourselves. So we need to, instead of reaching into purity spirals and all of these kind of things, just like I said to you before we went live, I love what Laura does. You know, she kind of took the words, everything I wanted to say, she almost said, but she is a perfect example of that, giving ordinary people a voice and reaching back to just normal people and not getting overly lost in the weeds. That was a long introduction I just gave you there. But yeah, that's, I don't know if that covers me. I think that's what I'm about plus a 5 minute ramble, I think.
No, people are asking for your Twitter, so I was just looking for your Twitter so that I could link them to it. I'll get that in the live chat just now. Here it is. Yeah, I think that there is, as we, Laura and I were saying, there is a tendency for this to become a kind of greenhouse where we only talk to each other and then we forget about how we sound to the outside, to ordinary people, to laymen might be a better term for them. And then it becomes very insular and unhealthy and unproductive, actually. Because, I mean, all of this is about communication in the end. So we need to communicate with the general public. And our enemies, their perhaps main tactic is to make us seem unpalatable to the general public so that we can't communicate with them. It's to cut us off from the mainstream, from ordinary people, so that they don't want to hear from us.
Yeah, I noticed that myself. And it's a topic, I've been on a few streams in Ireland and all of this, so people might think I'm repeating myself. Then again, your audience is not Irish, so maybe I get away with this. A big example of that I have personal experience with is a town in Ireland that was one of these asylum centers was being put into the town. And it was my kind of fifth time at the rodeo doing this, kind of helping a town, basically liaising with a town of people, if you can do such a thing, to defend themselves, giving them the rhetoric, the facts, all of this kind of stuff. And I did it, among other people, I did it with this town called Uachtaráid, right? Strange sounding place for people who aren't Irish. But anyway, there's this town, Uachtaráid, and they went into this long pitched battle, non-violent battle, of course, with the Irish state to have this center stopped, because previous ones had just gone ahead anyway, in spite of voting and all of this. So what they did was they camped outside the asylum center and stayed there for about 3 weeks. And it turned into just this massive fiasco for the state, It's since come out that there were internal dialogue going on, or there was internal dialogue going on between the government. They were panicking about it. And I was liaising with that town, giving them, I can't even speak about it too much now because I respect, I don't want to betray them, but there was a certain amount of that. And I was empowering them with the language and all this stuff among other people, because it's my little niche thing. The Irish newspapers and the Irish state, all of the NGOs as well, government-funded activists, came down extremely hard on them, on the town for talking to far-right people. And then it became anyone who was exposed to have spoken to me was then going to be far-right if they didn't condemn me. And if people didn't condemn them, their own neighbors, then they would be far-right. So there's a chain of you have to disavow. That was going on. There was an Irish Times article put up about me with two out-of-context tweets to trying to assemble this far-right thing. And it was shocking to me how heavy that came down. And it just speaks to what you mentioned, is this creating distance between us and ordinary people.
Well,
at the moment,
I could go on about my own doxing and the way they presented me. It was just, you know, it's incredible. When you realize how vicious the mainstream media are prepared to be, you know, it's quite gobsmacking. It's astonishing because there is no mercy. There is no decency. There's no honesty. And even no restraint. I mean, they will go very cartoonish in presenting you as... you would almost think that they wouldn't do this because the public won't believe it. It's just too over the top. But they go for it.
Yeah, people don't know. The public don't... They hear far right and they respect the press and all of this stuff. But I do think you need to... When something like that happens to you, you just need to go kind of go for it. Just say, I don't care what they say. I tried to brush it off. Because it didn't matter anyway. You know, all I would need for any person who believed that far-right article would be 30 seconds of each person's time, and I could debunk it immediately. The problem is that they have the power to do that. And what they're really trying to do is put that in the search bar. So you search Garrod Murphy now, you won't take long to find that. So they're basically trying to ruin your life. And, you know, when the situation is that hot and heavy, you need to, I don't know. That's the thing I feel like, you know, a big theme of millennial has been, what about the next decade? What about the last decade? This is the decade for me. And I'm speaking within legal, you know, everything normal, of course. I don't mean anything out of the ordinary. But, you know, it gets serious this decade. I think from 2016, it's been a bit of a, you know, a bit of play. And you know this since you're doxing, but it's escalating now to that sense where they really are, you know, it's kind of existential at this point where they're coming at you. And like Laura said, people need to band together to support each other. And that's one of the points I wanted to make about Ireland, is that Ireland is such a small country. There's 5 million population. Probably a quarter of those are foreigners anyway. So it's like 4 million of us, so to speak. And, you know, that's not so big that we can't support each other. So I don't worry as hard about tech companies or whatever, because most of the people who subscribe to my channel, I don't have a huge subscriber base or anything, but most of them I've probably shaken hands with at some kind of activism or another. So, you know, creating jobs for people, creating, trying to help, all of these things that Laura mentioned, and she's really into this, so she could speak to it better than me, and she did, but housing and this and that and everything else, rallying around each other. But I don't know. I like when I see that article where they tried to come at me directly. And of course, that information was fed to them from NGOs who are paid by the Department of Justice, who are the ones putting the asylum center into this town. So, you know, it's you versus the state at that point. Do you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Enemy of the state. I mean, it's not really anything short of that. In my case, it was, the media, a private company, but you know, the BBC have also said things about me here and there. It does happen. You know, I think especially in the case of Ireland, the state is involved in a deeper way than in Britain. In Britain, I think it is still the private companies, private media who are doing this. But then again, I shouldn't say that. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, like I can't compare because I don't know England's condition, and every nationalist says, a Swedish nationalist will say it's worse in Sweden than, and so will a French and so will a Canadian and everything. So I don't want to say that, but we do have a heavily, you know, fortressed opposition going on. between NGOs and all of these different things. We had a protest a couple of weekends ago. I've lost track with Christmas now and everything, but it was a free speech rally. So the sitting government want to introduce hate speech legislation and all of this. And we went to oppose it. We, a kind of band of different people, nationalists and all sorts. And then we were counter-protested by a whole slew of NGOs. And I worked out in a little bit of kind of back of the envelope, adding it up, that there was about 30 million annually opposing us in this protest. And there were still only 200 of them. But I was like, wow, even to get 200 people, they need about 30 million quid to put up these kind of Antifas and NGOs and all of the different ones you can imagine. You'd probably recognize some of the names. And I just, when I look at that, that's a white pill. That's I see that and I revel in it, because that's, I go, 200 people for 30 million, us free, about the same. If you look at that in a game theory sense, we win. So
yeah.
Is that a bit too simple?
I think this is a very, very good point. It's something that has come up here and there in Millennial, but it's worth saying explicitly that while our opposition is very powerful in terms of its effect, a massive amount of energy is going in to create that amount of power, that relative amount of power. And it's going, it's all being summoned, it's all happening in response to us, where we are working for almost nothing. The amount of energy and, well, money that goes into creating the dissident right, and I would include all of this in the dissident right, the amount of money that goes into creating it is tiny compared to the money that goes into creating the response to it from the mainstream. And yet it happens because they're that frightened of us. It's a very sobering thought.
It is. It's inspiring. And, you know, you say very little money. I mean, I would say maybe you could count this Patreons and all of this kind of stuff as money. But I think if you were to kind of really analyze it, there's negative money. Because think yes. of how many people lose money, opportunity foregone, time put in, all of that. I think we're operating at a massive net. We're basically paying in to make all of this happen, and we're willing to do so. We're willing to endure some levels of hardship and, you know, all of this kind of social repercussions and all of this. We can do that. We've weathered it. The other side, you know, when things turn on these guys, I go back to the asylum thing in Ireland. You know, these guys don't cope very well when they become unpopular. And I've seen in some of these towns, they get very unpopular very quickly. I kind of labeled them the subverters. I basically did a few videos and would tweet and post on. So I labeled them subverters and pointed out how they kind of were vaguely kind of getting backhanders from the government and were, you know, pointed out all of these things. And suddenly these towns became aware of it, and these NGO people would become very unpopular. There's one at the moment who, the first town I kind of engaged with is like, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago now. And the woman who was at the receiving end of it, I didn't abuse her or anything. I just pointed out true facts. 2 years later, she's writing a book about how traumatic it was. Right now, she's writing a book, and it's being crowdfunded to have this book go out, and all of the newspapers will kiss her arse and push it out for her. They are deeply wounded when you take the upper hand on them. And that's the other point I just want to make tonight. I don't know if it ties into the kind of the stream of consciousness here for us, but is, you know, that thing of connecting with ordinary people, it's so worthwhile. You know, at any time in England or Scotland or Wales or Ireland, there's going to be something happening, whether it's sex education in a school or, you know, this kind of perv education and or an asylum center or something. There are always people around who are helpless. They don't know how to navigate the media. They don't have the chains of signal boost, let's say, that we have. Those people are just waiting to be approached. And of course, once you do it, the newspapers will say you're pulling strings. You're like, you become a Russian bot, but still they react to it like vampires to garlic. It's so much fun. Actually, I think it makes it worth, I wouldn't enjoy doing this if it wasn't for that kind of action.
That's an important point. Cause I often bring this up myself, that Saul Alinsky said that activism should be fun. What would you say about that?
I was just on mute there. Yeah, absolutely. It should be fun. It should be, basically it should be fun, but it should involve a social outlet too. People should have a social outlet. People should have something to go to once in a while. And there's this whole thing from, I think there's a hangover from the USA with Charlottesville. You know, people are afraid to leave the house now because they think the feds are going to spoil their parade or whatever. But look, that was America. That was a few years ago. You can learn from the mistakes of that and not do them, which is what I always say. You know, just because something went bad doesn't mean you don't do it. You just say, let's do that, but not have it be a complete fuck up, right? You know, that's, it is possible to improve things, you know, and adjust. But a person, I'd say you're familiar with her, Gemma O'Doherty. She's a ex-journalist, or she's a journalist now, but she's got a wide range of things she's interested in. She's not for everybody. But what she did here was, she's basically retired now, so she kind of has the time and the resources. She would just protest, and she's kind of, you know, a very unique person. She has the ability to protest a place with three other people, you know, three times a week and just do it. And she would gather, people would come and come and come to these things. And now I owe it to her. I think we all owe it to her. It's kind of self-sustaining. It doesn't involve her anymore. People now expect something here in Dublin every couple of weeks, maybe every month. We're going to have another free speech protest in February the 2nd, I think. And of course, the whole point is people behind the scenes thinking about how to manage it effectively. But people are starting to enjoy that outlet, and it's fun.
That sounds like what I thought London would be like. I think London, for a brief period, for about 6 months, was like that at the height of the Tommy thing. And well, then, unfortunately, it isn't like that anymore. I thought it would be a sort of non-stop, like every 2 weeks, 3 weeks, there'd be something going on. But I think once the state neutered Tommy Robinson by putting him in jail and making the stakes seem very high, the potential cost seemed very high, people just understandably got very scared.
Yeah, maybe I sound naive. You know, maybe the bigger fish or the bigger boys in the class, the UK and France and US, could kind of snigger at me and say, you know, he's too big for his boots here in Ireland. But, you know, and yes, maybe something will happen. They will throw a spanner in the works and make something happen. And now there's a whole new era where we can't kind of leave the house anymore or do stuff like that. But, you know, they can arrest us. I mean, the unique thing here is that we have a history of kind of, you know, with the old independence movement here. It's written into our history to go to jail and to be persecuted for your political beliefs. So it's almost like fulfilling the prophecy here, you know, to be arrested. So in a way, they're creating problems for themselves. Like the British Empire's biggest mistake for Ireland was to hang the revolutionaries of 1916. And that's admitted. Most English nationalists and even unionists will admit that. That was a massive mistake. You don't make martyrs out of people. So I like to think in advance of these things. They make martyrs out of us, they lose. They don't make martyrs out of us, we just continue, they lose. You know, and in terms of throwing a spanner in the works, they did something a couple of months back. There was a protest outside Google, and it was Gemma, this woman I was talking about a while ago, and it was this big kind of anti-Google, anti-censorship protest, and a whole slew of shitlibs showed up, unicorns, LGBT, NGOs, whatever, Antifas, and to oppose it. And
it's such a bizarre situation where we've got massive corporations and then they're operating through the medium of, you know, transvestites, lesbians, feminists, vegans, and you know, all the rest. Utterly bizarre. Yeah.
It's like that kind of Hunger Games style or whatever. There's probably a better example of it. That degeneracy, you know, of like late stage, whatever. I don't know. I'm not very, you know, well read on these things, but you know what I'm getting at, this kind of weird people having horns and that kind of weird stuff. But anyway, this spanner that was thrown in the works was this guy came forward in the middle of our protest, which was just, again, ordinary people, right, with signs, Irish flags, and he came forward. Nobody knew who he was, and he threw up a Nazi salute, or a Roman salute, as some people like to say. And, you know, we managed to kind of bust that as being a psyop, you could say. And of course, nobody's ever proven it. But I think anybody who would look at it would agree that on the balance of things, that it looked dodgy, right? And we managed to neutralize it by acting very, very quickly and have cameras everywhere pointing in every direction. And that's a case where in advance and post facto, or whatever the Latin term is there, we managed to neutralize that. Like they threw their little trick in and it didn't work. He showed up again a few weeks ago. Stuff like that. I don't know. I like to go to these protests and, you know, be waiting for something to happen and try to manage it. And every time they try to do something, you turn it back on them. And we did that again a couple of weeks ago. We ended up having an IRA splinter group, effectively attacking children, literally video of it. Women and children being attacked.
Yes, so, I saw that on Twitter. It's state-funded people attacking children. It was quite incredible.
But that happening doesn't appear out of. I'm going to take the credit for that, basically, right? Sorry, but that doesn't appear out of nowhere. You have to be ready and waiting for something to happen. And it's not like a matter of creating fake news. It really happened, but you just have to be ready to, you know, a protest or an event. And I'm not a very seasoned organizer or any of that, but just, you know, these things, when a thing is happening like that, it's not happening in the moment. You have to think future, think past, and like zoom out to 1,000 feet and look down on it and just think, I'm not here right now. This is all about how it rolls out after. So I think when you kind of have a lot of people, as many people as you have protesting, you should have people there with cameras, people ready at home to tweet and do all of this kind of stuff, you know, to prepare for the message, because it is all about the message. And if you can consistently win on the message, then I think you're doing well, you know?
Definitely. So we were going to start with, as a sort of doing a summary or an introduction to the Irish political situation. Is there anything else you'd want to say about this, what we're saying just now, before we go into that?
No, not really. So the Irish political situation.
Yeah, I know it's a complicated question because it is, and Irish politics does tend to be complicated for historical reasons. So introduce the players that are on the board today that people should be aware of today if they want to understand an event.
Okay, well, I'm not going, again, I'd like to plead ignorance at all stages because I don't know. I'm not in-depth knowledge on everything. I'm not extremely well-read or a historian or any of that, just from what I know. You have this Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They are both parties which have a legacy in the independence. In the 1930s, there was a difference between them or whatever. You know, one of the parties originated from the Blue Shirts, which was a movement, basically a fascist movement in the 20s, 30s, I think. There's a picture in Cork, Ireland's second largest city, from, I think it's the 30s, of I think tens of thousands of people doing Hitler salutes in the 1930s, which, of course, you know, that's just the history. You know, European history was complicated back then, and people from both sides, communist and fascist, went to Spain, all of this stuff. But these days, both of those parties, which are the leading ones, they've swapped power for basically since our independence. In 2019, they are the very same thing. They are a neoliberal, kind of neocon, whatever. They're just a beige, technocrat, liberal, whatever. And now they're into the global, I can't say the word you think I'm going to say, global liberal, we'll say. They're both global liberal and they're both kind of free market economics. So you don't even get the good side of social or left-wing policies. You know, they're cruel on housing and cruel on healthcare and everything else. But and they are into that. So it's basically a uni party. It's a dictatorship in a strange technocratic sense. And Ireland is effectively, as Keith Woods told you, run by multinationals and all of this stuff. But to stick with the actual political parties, who are effectively just the managers, they swap power and they manage the shop, so to speak. I think of Ireland as kind of like a landing strip, like a green zone in Baghdad or something, where we are a gateway to Europe. We're English speaking. We have tertiary education, and they see us as a landing strip. You go to the bank district kind of in Dublin and the social media companies, Facebook and all of that. And it's just like being in, I don't know, Saudi Arabia, where everybody's an expat and it's kind of, there's high life kind of for them and it feels fake. And there are these bars playing this crappy music and it's just, and hipster, you know, little things. You've talked a lot about that stuff, those nice things. But anyway, on the other hand, with the political parties, the third force you have, the real one, because there's Labour and there's this and that, but the real third factor, I think, as, besides the Greens, who, you know, is self-explanatory, is Sinn Féin, which is, again, I'm not an expert on this, but they go back as being, you know, the nationalist party, the anti-unionist party, the Irish independence, all of that stuff, right? Most people know that. But they, too, have become global liberal, right? insert the real word. You know what I'm saying. Rainbow flag, all of that.
So, okay, just to interject, this is Fine Gael and the other one?
Fianna Fáil.
And then Sinn Féin. So Sinn Féin is ostensibly nationalist, is that correct? But it's actually, it's like the SNP, Scottish nationalist.
They're exactly like the SNP, and they are, you know, rainbow flag waving, open borders, promoting. And that kind of happened. That has happened in the last decade or so. And the interesting thing is that they are this, and they pin their colors to the, and you know, they were the political wing of the IRA and all of that, right? But the really interesting thing going forward, effectively, and this is the key thing, is that the Sinn Féin voters are working class voters. They're voters from the countryside, maybe they're voters from estates, you know, council estates. And plenty of other places too, but you know, that's the kind of feeling, maybe like Labour in the north. I think there's a lot of comparisons to Labour, but except it's more, I don't know, has more militant relationships going on. But that's kind of Sinn Féin. Their voters are effectively based in nature. They may not be on YouTube doing live streams and stuff, but in spirit, you know, they don't want immigration, they don't want transgender children, all of this stuff. And there's going to be this big gap in, emerge between people who vote for them and they themselves.
So, just to go back, you've got Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, who are effectively just status quo parties. Then you've got Sinn Féin, which is ostensibly a nationalist party, but is actually also a status quo party.
Exactly, yeah. So that's what you have. And then you have, so effectively, it's kind of like, in a way, yeah, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are kind of like, again, there's no clear blue sky between them. So they are basically the same thing. Just think of them as Fine Gael Fáil, right? And then you have Sinn Féin, which I suppose they do carry this kind of socialist thing, look after, you know, they kind of act as the Punch and Judy to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Oh, they're cruel. They're not socialist like we are, you know, and they kind of play that role, but, and they're more nationalist, which is kind of irrelevant because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I think, are nationalist too. The North is a complicated thing, but that's not the issue. Sinn Féin are really, people vote for them not because of the North, I think, except up there in the Republic of Ireland. People vote for them because they're the working class, the council estate party, the non-bourgeois party, and all of that. But yeah, they really are, like you said, there is no difference between them now. So they now are enveloped into the liberalism, and the interesting thing we will see going forward is how real nationalists in the sense that you and I are, these parties are going to emerge. I have no stake in that. I'm not a political operator, but these parties are beginning to emerge. You have the National Party, which has not contested an election yet. It's still in its kind of embryonic stage.
But that's Justin Barrett.
Yeah, Justin Barrett, yeah. And there are a few more. There's one called Irish Freedom Party, which was kind of rooted in Euroscepticism. And then you have a thing called Renew, which means kind of renewal or new. There's a few of them. And, you know, at some point, I know, and everybody knows that these things will come together in some sense, and, you know, a recession will come, and various things, you know, everybody knows in a number of years, sooner or later, this will become a force in Irish politics. It will become a fourth or a fifth force, and it will have one or two TDs or what do you call them in England? The
MPs
in Parliament. And, you know, once you have a few people in there speaking, imagine having a, you know, a MP or a TD in Parliament, you know, questioning demographics and all of this stuff. I mean, amazing. And they're trying to prevent that as well. Of course, their hate speech laws, which they're trying to put together now in Ireland, will encompass political speech, as in from elected politicians too. So that's all the fun. Again, I do look at it as fun. It's fun we have to look forward to. But yeah.
That was something I wanted to ask you earlier when you mentioned that they are trying to bring in, or they're in the process of bringing in, hate speech laws. Are there not already hate speech laws in Ireland? Because I'd be surprised, because obviously they've existed in England and Scotland for about 10 years now.
There have been ones since 1989, and I don't know the ins and outs of them, but they're called like the Incitement to Racial Hatred Act or something like that. But whatever the P's and Q's of those laws are, they're definitely not enough to cover, let's say, me saying that Irish people should have a say whether we become a minority or not, because clearly I haven't been arrested yet. So the thing they're crying and screaming about is that people like me and others aren't put in jail for saying, I have a list of these questions I like to keep next to me, these basic questions. And that's what these new ones will be for, you know.
What are those basic questions? Why don't you list them?
I have them. They're under a few cups here now. So
I'll just say, while you're sorting that out, I'll just say how amazing it is that these people think their modus operandi is to try to make it illegal to disagree with them, to try to get people who disagree with them simply cast as criminals. And then, well, you don't need to deal with them anymore. It's such amazing, a completely different attitude. And of course, it goes to show that they really do feel that they are in power. You know, this is gives the lie to the whole thing about them being the underdog.
But it is a form of insecurity, you know, because I feel like, you know, and it's a bit of a LARPy thing to say. I said it to someone today, kind of scoffed at me, or, you know, rightfully so, because it's a bit of a meme. But, you know, I said, when we take over, you know, that kind of language, when we take over, you know, I do often think about, do we afford free speech to our enemies who cynically use it and all of that stuff? You know, that question. And I personally think, yes, I would do it in the Lee Kuan Yew way, the Singaporean semi-authoritarian leader. He, if you read his memoirs, he talks about a lot of these cases where he was challenged on this and that fact. And he semi-censored newspapers. I could go into a ramble about that. I won't. But he would semi-censor these foreign newspapers and say, you can't advertise, but you can publish. And then they would choose not to. And then he would say, you can't publish, but you can have a copy of it at the library, which people can photocopy. So if they really need to know, they can do that, but you can't mass propagandize. And he would play all these games. And one of the big things he would do is say, you either debate me on the BBC or something, or you basically, he said, you know, when someone refuses to do that, then there's nothing more to be said. And he would, so that's the kind of attitude I would take, which is, you know, you have your free speech, but part of your free speech will involve kind of you must debate your accuser, stuff like that, you know, as a kind of a way of managing that question. But they don't do that. They don't. They could do that. They could go, oh, let's get them on TV and really ridicule them and question them. Of course, they don't do that. So they're so. I'm just trying to put myself in the position of 20 years when we take over, and how insecure I would have to feel to do what they do now, and I would. Well, that would be a pretty weak feeling. You
exactly.
Know?
We know that the truth is on our side. We know that most normal people don't want to be replaced in their homelands. That's a aspect of human nature. Of course they don't want it. We know that this has had to be done to them against their will and without their knowledge. We know that they would object to it if given a chance. And we know that if they were able to be introduced to us without bias, they would agree with us. Our opposition have none of those reassurances.
It's really clear to me, again, the practical experience I have with these asylum centers is so vast, because I don't want to even name towns. And sorry if I keep returning to this, but I think it's a lot more important sometimes than some ideological stuff, you know, depending on what mood you're in. But, you know, I have seen you go to a town, I've sat down with people, big amounts of people, right, and said, I don't sugarcoat my views. I say, well, I don't want to become a minority in the next 20 or 40 years. I don't start talking about IQ. That's not my preoccupation anyway. So my questions are basic and normal. And they go, yeah, it's almost like I'm saying it to them, expecting them to be kind of, you know, wary. But they're kind of looking at me like, what else do you have to say, stupid? You know, like, yeah, obviously. And they're kind of like, well, why would you even say you believe that? That's kind of obvious. And it's like, okay, but then the press roll in and the NGOs roll in, and they get, people get really scared really quick. So that's the thing I really want to work on, is somehow, I'm always trying to develop a framework or something to improve, like, how do you get people resilient in advance for that attack? And that's what I would love to try and get better at, is to try and coach people in advance to say, you think you agree with me now, you think it's perfectly normal, and you think you will fight against the system. You do. I know you do. But things will change, and you need to be prepared for how it feels. It feels oppressive. It feels scary. It feels weird.
It feels terrifying sometimes. And when you're being vilified in the press, it changes your life. I mean, it's extremely unsettling.
People are afraid. Like, and one thing I noticed in a town in Dublin, like a kind of suburb of Dublin, there was a meeting on this perv sex ed thing. And again, it was all ordinary people, parents, you know, all sorts of people like they weren't like, so it wasn't some kind of radical political thing. They were all in this big, large pub, maybe 100 of them, and they were there against the sex ed thing. They just organically decided to meet there. And they were saying all sorts of base things in reality. And one thing really struck me was one of the guys said, you know, in Britain, they had the same problem. And maybe we should contact the Muslim community here, because in Britain, the Muslim community, our Muslim brothers and sisters, were very effective in pushing back against this. So they were so scared that they wanted to outsource the defense of their own children to Muslims, because Muslims don't have the same burden of political correctness. And this kind of stuff, it's so important to, I'm reluctant to use the word train, but to inform and empower regular people to how to withstand this kind of stuff. And again, the key thing, I think, is for those, and this is where the Irish Times and all of these newspapers say, I'm trying to pull the strings, and we all are trying to pull the strings, is that, but it's not that. It's you need to say, listen, we're out there already. We're already taking heat for being dissidents and activists. You just need to liaise with us. We will help you. We will help absorb the brunt of the trauma on this stuff. You just need to be kind of on our side and our buddies and our guys. And when you do that, there is still such thing as private communication. You know, then we are your support. And also maybe vote for the political party, and that political party will support you and be your voice. So then you don't have to take the heat. And even if it's a town of 500 people, a town of 500 people, you don't need to, or even a city or whatever, you know, act in numbers. None of you need to be the one guy on the top. That can be me, or that can be Justin Barrett or whoever. But you just need to not, when the Irish Times say, and that goes back to the thing a while ago, this town Uachtaráid, the Irish Times put the heat on, laser focus heat, to try and drive a wedge between us and them. And it almost worked. But that's what they're deathly afraid of, is this connection between activists and dissidents like us, who like to think about stuff and dwell on things and all of this, and ordinary people. And I think that's a huge thing we need to do all over the place in the next few years, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Would you think about actually creating a formal organization that had a name and a website and so on that people could contact? Or is there no need for that? Or would that be a disadvantage?
I almost think it's a disadvantage. Now, that could be my laziness speaking. You know, it's kind of like a little alibi for my laziness. Like, oh, well, I don't think that's very wise now for me to, you know, have agency here. I don't think that would be very smart. But maybe not, because having that point, that thing that people can look at. Now this NGO, which is like called Irish, you know, Freedom or something, it's now the far right organization designated. Maybe the ADL will even designate us kindly. Whereas if you're just, I like that idea of complete grassroots, we're just people, we're just doing our thing. And there is no, I know people in our, I don't do things by myself. There's people who are anonymous, who are real people. They like to say they're bots, but they're anonymous online, but they do great kind of awareness raising, to use an NGO term. And, you know, what was my point on that again? Is that, yeah, to have it loose like that, and it's just ordinary people. In a way, that's been a good thing, to be honest.
Right, right. I wondered about that. What about, what was the next? I had a question stored up and it's just gone.
I can step in for you if you want.
Yes, go for it.
Okay. Well, just to elaborate on a previous point, I talked about this kind of Sinn Féin, and they were previously, it's kind of now whatever.
I've remembered the question. Sorry, sure. This won't be long. It's interesting that you paint a picture of normal people in a town, and they know that there's something's going to happen, and they don't like it, and they're prepared to oppose it, and they're quite brave and all that. And then the NGOs come in and terrify them. Is that too strong a word? See, it seems definitely that the NGOs silence them, intimidate them. And it's amazing. I think that a lot of people in Britain, at least, are not accustomed to this concept. It seems to be happening in a much more, everything seems to be happening in miniature in Ireland, much more concentrated, so that the NGO actually arrives in the town and people see it tangibly and are scared of it.
I think it might be a matter of proportions, because bear in mind that Ireland, if you count us as 4 or 5 million, somewhere around there, that's like half of London. You know, think of it that way, spread over a country where kind of people know people, and, you know, so it's just, maybe that's the root of that dynamic. But yes, NGOs arrive in places and scare them. There's material on this. Maybe I should create a playlist, because I'm going to plug one of my videos here, but there's more than my video. I think my video is a pretty good comprehensive thing. It's called, and I usually wouldn't do this, but it's just as we're talking about it, I happen to have a thing that is pretty comprehensive on this. If you want to watch a two-hour video to the viewers, I'm sure they don't. But it's called The Asylum Industry. And basically, I spent like a year and a half going to these different towns and seeing it all happen, getting to know many people there, taking their phone numbers and being in contact with them daily. And they would tell me what's going on and all of this stuff. And I would try to learn all of the politicians, the counselors, everybody there, all the names, and then figure out who these NGO people are. Some of them are kind of local. They might be from 20 miles away. So they would kind of be drafted in. And it's kind of questionable as to whether or not they were in direct contact with the government or even paid by them. But they were in some contact. And yes, it is like terrorism in the lesser sense, where they really would. I mean, I could go on and on. There were examples where I called into an office one day and spoke to this one NGO woman. And I was like, I have simple questions. I just want to ask you, did you know about this? Because you were claiming to be a chairperson of the meeting for the town. But did you know about this center in advance of the town knowing about it? And if so, how and why? You know, stuff like all of these kind of questions. And in that instance, she kind of kicked me out after a while when she realized I was hostile. Then she went on to all of her NGO friends who were local to this town, saying, go into town and tell people not to speak to anyone who isn't a credentialed RTE, which is our BBC, who isn't a credentialed RTE or a credentialed journalist, one who you know will spin the yarn as you need them to. So they would say this kind of stuff, and it's shocking. I'm kind of almost over it now, but now that you ask me from a fresh perspective, I'm becoming shocked at it from scratch, because it's like, it's unbelievable how this works. But again, it is fun to combat that.
No, and it's like in on the BBC, we'll only have Guardian journalists on, or they'll only have independent journalists, or some, you know, khaki Daily Telegraph journalists. They won't have someone from Breitbart. They won't have someone from the dissident right or anything like that, for sure. So they maintain homogeneity, the ideological homogeneity, by simply cutting large swathes of people out of the conversation.
You know, I actually think England, the UK, whichever, is a lot better on that. I've always remarked on that. So I slightly disagree with you from an Irish perspective, because yes, it's, you know, it's set up and it's rigged and everything, the media, the TV shows and chat shows, but you will get Douglas Murray on. And I know you have your issues with Douglas Murray. I do too. Of course, when you get into the finer points, you go, this is, you know, a kind of a redirection, all of that stuff. But still, he's still an entry point, at least. He's something. And you get that. On Irish media, there is no one. There is only the left and the whatever. It's painful to watch. You have no pretense of opposition. I'm trying to think of more people than Douglas Murray. I don't know, Peter Hitchens, you mentioned him with Laura. I don't know much about him, but I know he's something of a, you know, some form of right winger. You don't get any of that on Irish media. It's absolutely laughable. And my thing is just, you know, don't watch it. Get people to watch our YouTube channels. I don't want to go on. They tried to invite me on one of those shows to set me up. It was I don't know how much I can talk about it, but they had me set up. They basically had my ball, like their, what's the term? They had me by the balls, they would have thought, if they had gotten me on. They had a little trick up their sleeve, and it wasn't to do argumentation or facts or any of that. They had a little trick, and my attitude is like, I'm not going on. I'm not going on a show where you have it all set up for someone to kind of betray me on live or something like that, you know, because they're under pressure, you know, in their own way, and they know they can apply that pressure and all of this. Maybe get someone from a town to say, we don't want your kind, we don't want your far right, when perhaps you might have, you know, had perfectly amicable dealings with that person in real life, you know. So something like that. And then, of course, your response will be 20 seconds and take it away. I'm not doing that. The whole idea of right wingers, I don't know. I just don't think there's any point in that. I like having an independent structure to the state. So you have state NGOs and state media. Just stay away from all that stuff. Set up, like Laura said, set up your own community, set up your own world, and become resilient and move forward on that basis. Bring people to you. Don't go to them, you know?
Yes, I think that would be the ideal. And I had long had a policy of just not talking to the media at all. And my website makes it very clear that if you're a journalist, do not use this contact form. I will not reply and all that. I don't know. Sometimes I think about opening the gate to them, and just so that for the sake of gathering recorded interviews, you know, that would be my those would be my terms. I have to be able to record the whole interview and publish it myself. That's what Jared Taylor's now doing.
And yeah, I think Jared.
Go on.
No, Jared Taylor, that approach is obviously to not do that is almost, it's beyond silly. It's almost you know, that can't be allowed almost. It's so wrong because not only are you wrecking yourself, if you get wrecked on telly by editing and all that, you haven't just done harm to yourself, you've done harm to everybody else too, but more importantly. But, you know, a little epiphany I had recently is all of these like politicians who, we have this in Ireland now where we have these politicians trying to gather energy from the dissident right in Ireland by opposing us. You know, they can be now the foil, the kind of Batman and Robin or Batman and Joker, this kind of thing. And it's like, no, they're not going to steal our energy by being, because they get protection, they get airtime, they get money by being our enemies. And it's like, stop being provoked by those people. Don't let them, make them irrelevant. And my take is like, what you do with these people is you say, I will debate you on a neutral YouTube channel, not on the national TV, at some form of agreed YouTube channel or another. And we debate for exhaustively, 2 hours, whatever, right? And unedited, live. And if you don't want to do that, then you go in the rear view mirror. You're gone. Yes. Bye.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes, I agree. I mean, my only objection to that is that I know most of them wouldn't do it. And no. then we'll miss out on both entertainment and valuable recordings. But you know, if the only alternative is that we go on the mainstream media and get crucified, then it's pointless. You know, it really has to be all or nothing, I think.
Yeah, it's not worth that, and the risk is too kind of high. Now, someone could say that about doing protests as well and accuse me of that, but I think the risk of TV is kind of too high. They're not bringing you on to win, you know. That's quite clear. But yeah, debating these guys, whatever they are, I don't like calling them lefties, because they're, you know, that's not it.
But globalists.
Globalists, yeah, exactly. And like to, you know, I would love to get, I got one of them at one of these Google protests accidentally, and we started talking for like half an hour. Oh, God, and I think even she would admit that, not to sound like Ben Shapiro, but I destroyed her, you know. I think she would probably admit it. It was just unbelievable. She kept, and it was so interesting how she kept trying to lead me down these rabbit holes. You know, would you like stuff like, how would you describe, or like, you know, why are you afraid of immigrants? You know, stuff like that. Like these smarmy little questions. And you just have to go, hold on a second now. I never said I'm afraid of immigrants. Immigrants are okay. What I'm saying is X, Y, and Z. You know, and these are just all these little tricks. But to have them, I walked away from it being like, that was so enjoyable. I felt addicted. And yet I haven't.
It's a real thrill, isn't it? Once it gets started.
It's more fun. It's more fun than doing, making a video for yourself. It's more fun than doing, as you know, with all due respect, it's more fun than even doing a live stream with someone you get on with. It's more fun than any of that. It's so exhilarating. And you know,
yeah. Somebody's saying, did you not record it, this half hour conversation?
No, because I had my phone out in my hand when I went up to her. It was just in my hand idly. And we got about 30 seconds in and she looked down at my phone, panic stricken, and said, are you recording that? And I had to kind of go, just because I wanted the conversation to go on, I had to go, no, I'm not. Here it goes in my pocket.
That's exactly what I mean. You want the thrill and of the combat, but you know, you can only have that if you agree not to record it. So then it's kind of pointless. It's good practice, of course, that at any rate. So, but it's unfortunate that the rest of us can't hear it because it would have probably been very enjoyable. That's the thing. I mean, I don't want to trivialize it, but it is entertaining. You know, when it's like a really meaty conversation and the cut and thrust of debate, it is entertaining.
It's kind of like I find what I felt about, because it was one of the first debates I'd had. I've had debates with like kind of friends, like normal people who try to debate you, but they're not committed. They're just in a neutral kind of position. So, you know, whatever, you know, but it was my first opportunity in a long, long time to get someone who's a committed diehard globalist kind of person standing there in front of you, who doesn't know who you are, who thinks maybe you're just some fool, and they try all these tricks on you. And as she's trying them on me, I can feel, no offense to anybody else, but I can feel someone who might not be as ready for something like this making the mistakes. Why are you afraid of immigrants? They go, well, the reason I'm afraid of immigrants is because there's crime and there's this and there's that. And you go, no, don't answer that question. You know, of course. But, what was he going to say? Oh, yeah.
Reject the premise.
Yeah, questions. Yeah. And why would you ask such a thing? Like, you know, why would you do that? That's very silly. But I had been a couple of years doing my own little bits of activism and thinking about things and everything. This is the first time I got to, and I need to be careful to not use an unfortunate analogy that could get me in trouble. Let's just say someone who's been in the gym for a while, you know, who finally gets to go out and lift some weights. And it was a thrill. Yeah. And it's fun. So if we could get that going, that's worth trying to pursue hard. But it, again, though, it's one of these things where you win either way. If they debate you on reasonable terms, they obviously lose. And if they don't, you can use that. You can go, listen, I keep asking people to debate me and they won't. So look, you know, and that in itself is a little bit of a strength and a little bit of a boon, you know.
Somebody has suggested that a good response would have been, why are you afraid of a white country?
See, yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit funny on the term white.
I thought you would be because I've experienced this before. Let's just say, why are you afraid of an Irish country? But of course, that leaves them. Well, anyone can be Irish. So yeah.
I don't know. No offense to the commenter, but there's something about that question doesn't. It's a bit too alt-right or something for me. And I know that could be contentious or whatever. It's a bit too, I don't know. Yeah, an Irish country, that's okay. I don't mind saying an Irish country. Maybe I'm pushing buttons here. People will be annoyed, but it's just, I'm from a certain place where, and maybe you are too in Scotland, but it's just, I don't, you know, why are you afraid of an Irish country? I mean, what I would go with, this is just a personal preference thing. Some people like strawberries, some people like, you know, oranges, right? I would say, why do you hate Irish people? That would be mine.
Well, yeah, the trouble is that she would just reply, but anyone can be Irish. That's the trouble. This is the trouble with the word white. If you avoid that word, then they'll say, well, anyone can be Irish. Anyone can be English. Yeah. So it's one of those things where I think we make things more complicated for ourselves by rejecting that term.
Okay, we could have a little, this could be our debate now, white or not white, Scottish or whatever. I don't know, my thing on white, it's just the cost of that is so massive in Ireland anyway. You know, the idea and the weight of Irish is so strong in Ireland, I just, without getting too intellectual about it, it strikes me as completely obvious that you would avoid. If you say white, like, I sound like E. Michael Jones here, actually, but, you know, if you say white, you are, to the eyes of someone who, you know, most, 99% of people, you're a white nationalist in America. And that's honestly got nothing, that's very little got to do with my concerns, like, really. I mean, I care about white America and America and all of this kind of stuff. You know, they deserve to stop immigration and all of this kind of stuff. And I'm kind of cucking out now on it already. You know, I'm starting to get jittery. But, like, you know, like, white Americans have a right to push back on immigration and say they're losing their country as it was and, you know, how they know it, all of that kind of stuff, right? But all it's going to be is white nationalist. I would put the onus on either you or the questioner on the value of using that term in Ireland to me.
As I said, if you don't use that term, then they can say, well, a black person is just as Irish as anyone else. So I'm not afraid of an Irish country. I just want it to be multicolored.
But here's my thing. And you might call me like a globalist for this, right? But I don't want, I understand all of the white stuff and all of that, but I don't want, say you go with white, you say, I use the word white in place of Irish for every argument I make. Then we have 500,000 Polish and maybe Georgian. Those are a number one asylum seeker population, speaking completely different languages. You know, that to me, they're foreign, right? Straight away. Yes. Like, I could say they're my European brothers and all of that stuff. To me, they're just kind of foreigners, right? Maybe I would take them over someone else from further afield, but to me, they're just foreigners. And they're also bodies in the country taking up housing and all of this and kind of acting as a wedge in any kind of cohesive culture and all of that. So that would be my first retort is, you know, I don't really have a leg to stand on when I use white, whereas Irish would actually be the most appropriate. And I can define Irish. You can say Vikings came here 1600 years ago and all of this stuff. But if you go through it, you can kind of define what Irish is. And that is the accurate. It's not a matter of cooking or not cooking. It's just the accurate phrase to use for the kind of nationalism I'm interested in.
I understand your position. I'm just saying I think that you're probably making it more complicated for yourself than it needs to be. Because if you're going to go back, well, here's what I mean by Irish. I mean, 1600 years ago and other invasions, incursions, etc. Then they'll say, what's the difference now with new people arriving from farther afield? You know,
I'm a big fan of the word foreigners. To me, they're just all foreigners, you know?
Yeah. But then I guess they could hold your feet to the fire and say, well, why aren't you protesting about Polish immigration then? You know, it's all, I think I am.
That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, okay, then I guess that solves that. I'm just wary of kowtowing it in any way to their paradigm, which is that, well, we know what it is. And I think that the term white is, in the end, it is all about that. I mean, I know that your Irish heritage and identity matters a great deal to you. I respect that. Swedish, people who object to mass immigration in Sweden, their Swedish heritage and identity means a great deal to them. Same with Germany, same with France, same with everywhere. But it's not happening to them because they're German or Swedish or Irish. It's happening to them because they're white. I mean, that is the collective thing. That is the thing that is being attacked. It's not happening to you because you're Irish.
I would agree. And I think there is nuance there where we're not taking dialectical opposing positions here because we more or less, I think, agree. If you talk about Europe, if I do talk about Europe and my concern becomes Europe, Italy, Scotland, Sweden, wherever, then I would say, I would just say Europeans, and it's not a matter of cooking. Maybe it's just a preference of vocabulary or something. Maybe the term white to me just doesn't roll off the tongue very well. But whether you want a synonym European for white, because all of Europeans are obviously white. But like, you know, I do agree that there is this pan-European thing that's happening to the, call it the white, call it the European world. And I agree with that. But to me, you know, and this is another thing we could talk about, my politics personally, it's not a disagreement. It's just me personally, a bit of relativism there. Me personally, it's my interest is in Ireland. And it's not because I love Ireland more than anywhere else. I do, but it's mainly that, and it's a point I was going to make, I had it scribbled down somewhere, is that, you know, I like the idea of nationalism going forward, that you have Laura Towler and yourself and Mark Collett and all these people in England, a kind of a sub-tribe, you know, of this larger European tribe, which is being attacked, of course, in Australia too, Western. I understand that, but that doesn't make any sense because it's on the other side of the world. It's a certain people. And I'm not shying away from the term white. They're white people, right, in general. But it's, you know, I do like the idea of the sub-tribe, the patriotic alternative in Britain, the Groypers in America or whoever, the Blair Cantrell, I think his name, Australia, and having all of these groups that are kind of developing their own strategy and doing their own thing. Aside from an ideological thing of whether you call yourself white, Scottish, Irish, whatever, I think it's just a pragmatic thing. I think in terms of think of it as a corporate structure. I think the structure of Irish people trying to rally on Irish, and we could talk, you know, you're from the UK or you're from Scotland and maybe someone's from America. We talk and we liaise. We are a bigger family of nationalists, of course, under the same pressures in a global context as white European people, whatever you want to call it, right? Or a civilization of Europeans. But I just think the best structure, organizational structure, and the most resilient one is nationalism. I think it's far better for Irish people to be delving into the Irish situation than delving into Richard Spencer's rally in California or something. I feel
Yeah, I don't think we disagree on anything here. It's simply a matter of we're speculating about tactics. And one other thing, just to actually play devil's advocate and go with you here, play Garode's advocate, you could say that to use the term white is to itself sort of engage in a type of globalism where we're sort of ignoring or negating our specific ethnic identities and going for a globalist thing.
I mean, I like to see, and now I'm devil's advocating or millennial woes advocating in reverse. So, but because when I hear you say things like you quoted it, or I don't know where you got it from, but you made a video on this recently, and Richard Spencer said it a while back, is the whole idea of it's not going to be nationalism versus globalism. It's going to be globalism, I think, versus globalism, isn't it? Something like that. And yes, I agree with that. I agree that this is, I don't for a minute think that Ireland is going to like cloister itself into its own little, you know, hermit kingdom and do all of this. I strongly reject that. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen between you and me, not to sound grandiose about it, but all of the different, like I say, all of these different tribes around the place, these little mini factions, European identitarians and all of this stuff. But just at a day-to-day, at a maybe a syntax, or not syntax, but vocabulary message and all of that, it needs to be local. And then we go back to each other for these kind of like, you know, table of the elves or whatever. You know, it's like, it's to me, that's how it works. And to, you know, there's a kind of a nuance in how to do that, how we relate to each other, but then we kind of have our own parlance. We kind of have our own way and our own tactics. So again, I could come back and say, this is really working in Ireland, and somebody else could, you know, I often see, you know, and so far as you see the disasters of maybe Charlottesville and some of the negative things that happened there and whatever, you know, you take the good bits and the bad bits, and then you offer good bits and maybe you offer bad bits, but at least people can learn from you. But again, it's more of an organizational thing, because when we talk ideology, I agree. I definitely agree. It is a global, it's not even global, it's civilizational and all of that. But I think I said it to, I think in a Morgoth stream ages ago, is that, you know, spend less time, this is just my feeling, spend less time thinking about the European civilization or whatever, and more time thinking about, you know, you can tell this is my brand or my perspective from the entire conversation we've already had. So it is a matter of perspective. What I said to Morgoth a while ago, probably the only useful thing I said on the whole stream with him, is fight them from the town level out. And that's my fundamental take. I would much rather fight them from the town level out, push them back to the cities, back to their Brussels master or wherever, and do it that way, because it's just more productive than being like Euro-civilizational thing. It's just a matter of hierarchy almost, you know?
Yes. It's almost like I'm reminded of that quote that's probably possibly apocryphal from Stalin that, well, to paraphrase, the death of one European country is a tragedy, but the death of all of Europe is a statistic, sort of thing. But it's almost too big to conceive of it.
Yeah, and there, you know, I don't know. It's kind of one of these things. Like I'm a bit of a fan of instinct. You know, you kind of know. I don't know. People sometimes get too wrapped up in this kind of minutia of like ideology or terminology and stuff. Not that it's irrelevant. Again, I always like to be nuanced. It's neither one nor the other, but it's kind of just look at both sides. There's a lot to be said for instinct. And, you know, I could come to Irish people, Irish nationalists who I know, and suggest that we call ourselves white. And then what would we be white? I mean, we are nationalists, so we're white nationalists. And I could just ask them, do they think that's a good idea? And they, I don't know. And again, I'm returning to the point of disagreement. I think we agreed on that already, so maybe not bring it up. But like, I don't know. And also, you know, I've said this to a lot of people recently. I have never been to England or to the UK. What's it called? Britain. That's the one, right? The island on the right, on the map. I've never been there beyond Heathrow and a lunch for 2 hours in London, right? Just haven't had the chance or whatever. And I want to go somewhere. I want to go to Devon and to these places and to the Scottish Highlands and all of these. But in the same way as I don't want to get to the Scottish Highlands and have a kebab pizza shop and a Starbucks and this and that, I also, to some extent, and I appreciate there's a big difference between me going to Scotland and me going to Somalia, right? I understand the nuance, the complete difference, right? We're the same in that context. But also, I don't want to get to Scotland and say, hello, my European brother, my white brother. You know, it's like, no, we're, you know, we do have our differences, and it's important to me personally. But yeah, I don't know. We're kind of rehashing old ground there. It's an old debate, isn't it? And it doesn't really matter.
It probably doesn't really matter, but I do understand the distinction, because it would be ridiculous for me to go over to Ireland and say, well, yes, we're all the same here, aren't we? I mean, that's incredibly presumptuous, but it would be of me to do that. It's fine for us to agree. I mean, it's one of those things where you ruin it by sort of being too heavy-handed about it. But it shouldn't be too emphasized. It shouldn't be too precious about it.
It speaks for itself. You know, I can go to the Netherlands and speak to people there about their nationalist struggles or whatever, and I might not have the same experience, you know, in China or, you know, Angola. Although, actually, you potentially could. But another example, when I said, like, you know, I go to Scotland and I say, hello, my European brother, right, and all of that kind of stuff. It maybe doesn't quite make sense, but yet we get on perfectly well and we share the same experiences. What about, let's say, and again, for the chat and all of this, I'm not against European cohesion and all. Of course, I'm totally for that. But think about it, a more extreme example than Scotland and Ireland. I go to Spain and I meet a person who is Spanish, who maybe isn't, you know, hasn't got a sophisticated bourgeois third level education, or they'd never bothered to learn English, right? They really don't have a word. They know hello. And I say, hello, my European brother. And he shrugs at me. I mean, you know, am I Irish in that sense, or am I European? I'm kind of Irish, right? You know,
It's probably one of these things that's relative, because if, say, a bunch of people from farther afield were to hove into view, you and that Spaniard might suddenly feel like you had quite a lot in common. I think it's probably relative to the situation. One thing I would say is I have friends that I speak to daily, well, not daily, but almost daily, from Austria, America, Finland, Norway, and various places. And I do think that this is a function, an effect of the internet, obviously, the modern world, that we do seem to be becoming closer together. I think this is something I've talked about before. I've sort of alluded to it, never really talked about it in depth because I don't really know what I would say about it. But I do think that these barriers are more, they're thinner than they used to be, put it that way.
Look at what we're doing right now, right? You're wherever you are and I'm here in Dublin and we're chatting about this stuff. And I could go out the door and try to speak to someone on this, and actually they might be from Pakistan. But you know, anyway, you know, even if they were Irish, imagine, they might not rock with it or vibe with that. But still, yeah, I do understand that barriers come down. It totally is. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I just love that. I think it's very, again, it's exhilarating and it's fun to have a contact in Poland or Spain or Netherlands or Germany or Scotland or, you know, who you're having this, I don't know, it's kind of like if you had told me that a number of years ago, I would have thought that's crazy. That's a crazy thing to do, you know, to have this political realm that is cross-continental. And not only do you talk to them online, like kind of like some kind of future dystopia, but you often meet them as well. And that brings it together. And that's the thing people forget. Some people, and you know, yeah, there are people out here who watch streams and stuff and they maybe haven't met people. Again, Laura Towler is rectifying that, and many others are. That is one of the keys to everything, to change that. We don't want that. We want to know each other to some extent and to feel a sense of familiarity or familiarity to each other. But yeah, I don't know. do you know what? Can I?
Yes. I was just going to say it's a very complicated situation, but I keep saying that, and it's like a bit of a cop out. But I don't know what else to say. So yeah,
it is. And it's great. Actually, one last thing on that, while we're at it, is that it's important because, like, again, this kind of familial thing of all these nations. You know, if something happens in Ireland or in the Netherlands or something, and it's a big deal, you know, it's an asylum center or a police officer beat up a nationalist for like saying they don't want to become a minority or whatever, you know, they might not have support from their media, but they have support from our media, from big channels like yours and from bigger channels again, and all of this stuff. That's important. So that's an element where the international family matters much more than, you know. So again, it depends what you're looking at. But I was just going to get back when I kind of rudely interjected there a while ago, was just a point I wanted to make. It's kind of not in keeping with the flow of conversation here, but it's stuck in my mind, is that, so this is totally throwing things, that IRA Sinn Féin history in Ireland, right? Because I think people do want to hear a bit.
We went off on a massive tangent, but yeah, let's go back to that.
So like this this IRA Sinn Féin thing, a lot of people would be interested to know because there's such, like, the stuff I hear sometimes is like, you know, I don't know, if I put up a video on YouTube and it's like something bad happening, like, oh my God, the place is turning into a, you know, we're losing all of this stuff, right? This kind of, oh, the, you know, the country's turning to going to the dogs with immigration or whatever. And I'll have like some, all respect to American listeners, right? Probably mostly American, could be English, I don't know. But people who aren't Irish will say, God, I think of it in an American accent, I'm sorry. But they will say, God, you guys really need to get the IRA back in there, you know, or something like that. And I'm like, it's not like that at all, guys. You know, I am Irish people. We're raised to want a unified country and all of that. And I won't disavow that, right? It's not even a point of logic to me. It's just, I don't know. You're raised on a culture and you're not going to let go of it, right? But that aside, if there's any unionists watching, let's not fall out about it right now. But, you know, this whole Sinn Féin / IRA, there's a bit of room between them and all of that. And then there's all the different splinters of that. That whole world is not nationalist. They're not nationalist in the sense that we know of it. Like I said, they are global liberal. They are everything else. And the fault line that's going to occur in Ireland, and I'm predicting this now, is that Sinn Féin, who have votes from working class people and people who like are nationalists and kind of based and kind of working class and all of that, their votes are going, once a cohesive option becomes available to them from nationalists like us and you, those votes will start dribbling over to our movement, and that will happen. And when that happens, you know, the militancy isn't there like it used to be. Of course, there aren't as many people, they've died off and they've gotten old. But insofar as there's any militancy left, you know, I don't mean to scare Irish nationalists, don't be afraid, but they will start getting spicy on this, I think, at some point. And to me, again, it's another battle I think we should just take on. And it doesn't mean anybody needs to be afraid. It's just one of those things. Again, at a protest a couple of weeks ago, this group called Sarah, right? They're called Sarah. It's an Irish name, or an Irish word. They showed up to this Antifa NGO government pro hate speech thing against us. And I went on a stream with Gran Torino, I'm sure you know him, and I said that they're drug peddling, murdering, because they murdered, or they didn't, I want to be clear, they didn't murder, but they were implicated by some in the murder of a journalist. I call them drug peddling degenerate scumbags. It's a long story, but a lot of this kind of republicanism is, and same with the unionists actually, some of them, a lot of this kind of paramilitary stuff is related to drug dealers and all of this stuff. It's not like legitimate stuff. Anyway, sorry, I will arrive at my point eventually. These guys showed up to it and they protested us, and I said mean things about them on a stream. I also said that they looked like a Play-Doh stuffed into skinny jeans and all of these kind of things. And in Ireland, these people aren't used to being insulted. So if it gets to the point, I'm not trying to make myself a big deal, but if it gets to the point where nationalists in general, our nationalists start to oppose them and steal their lunch, it's going to get very interesting. So it's just, I felt like saying that because it's a wrinkle in Ireland that is not shared by our European brothers, right? They, you know, every country has its own thing, but that's a little unique story here. Sinn Féin is our Labour, so to speak. And actually, that's another thing. I'm on a long ramble here. But if Sinn Féin are our Labour, the positive thing in Ireland is that we don't have a Tories. We have nothing, and you could consider that a retardation of a certain sort, right? You could consider that a stunting, or we have nothing. That sounds bad at the face of it. But on the other hand, we have our Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, nothing parties. We have Sinn Féin who are, we're going to steal their votes. And we have nothing that claims to be us, but is stealing our power because they have money and all of this stuff. So at least we get to start from the ground up now, and things are looking kind of good. And we get to build forward and we have some level of control over it. The people who care, the people who've been through some adversity and all of that. So we get to start it from the ground up. And that's a question I have for you. I don't know if you want to respond to any of this, but the question I have for you is like, how do British nationalists go about reconciling with Tories? How do you get in on that without stealing from the Tory vote and letting Labour win? Or do you steal Labour and Tory votes and create a third option?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the way to do it. We have to just point out that neither of these parties is on the side of ordinary British people. The Tories, the Conservatives, are, I think they're going to go for mass immigration now after Brexit. And that's just going to give the lie to the whole thing. And I think it will show those who voted for Brexit that the Conservatives are really not their party. The Conservatives just happen to be the vehicle by which those people could get Brexit, but nothing else. They can't get anything else from them except endless betrayal into the future.
And privatization and all of this stuff to go with it, on top of, as if it wasn't bad enough, right? Privatizing gas infrastructure, that's, you know, and that's already done. But, you know, I'm interested. I don't know if you have followed any of George Galloway's stuff. Have you noticed that he has made a little pivot recently?
Yes, and it's interesting. He's an interesting guy.
Very. Yeah.
He's. I don't know much about this recent thing. Of course, I still remember him. I hate to say, make a trivial point, but I remember him being on Celebrity Big Brother a long, long time ago with Pete Burns, who's now dead. The infamous clip that was all endlessly repeated. Prior to that, I remember him going over to meet Saddam Hussein and infamously saying the word indefatigability. Which I think was probably the only time most of us have ever heard that word. I salute your pride, your honour, and your strength, your honour, and your indefatigability. Very good. And other than that, I remember hearing him praise Lori Penny once. He had I think it was a podcast, and he had her on as a guest once. That's all I really know of George Galloway. And that he comes from, I think, Fife in Scotland.
He has, aside from his rhetorical skill and his kind of character, which is excellent, he does have a history. It's very interesting because he has a history of, like, one of his first things was to go to South Africa, and he was an underground operator for the African National Congress. So he, you know, helped to sink South Africa with his own, you know, on the ground. And he was a candidate in Bradford. As far as I know, Bradford is a Islamic area.
Yeah, so
he campaigned there, and he kind of, his shtick, I suppose, is semi, like, just the anti-Israel thing and the, you know, all of that. So he kind of engages in this anti-English, anti, you know, whatever, we've talked about that, right? I would say anti-English politicking. And, you know, that's hard to forgive. And people need, when he comes out and says immigration is a bad thing, it's, you know, it's hard to lose sight of his past and what he has said before. And that pivot is kind of strange and doesn't make sense. But at the same time, he's always had a good approach in a way too. He's always been anti the American empire, which is something I personally am as well. And, you know, he's always been anti-liberal, which is a huge thing. So he has his strengths and weaknesses. It would just be so interesting to sit him down with you or with whoever, but it's not going to happen. But, and that's another thing I'm really interested in too, is, and of course I'm going to kill the possibility of this ever happening by saying it now. It probably won't happen anyway, so I can do this. Is like, God, I don't want to get these lefties in trouble. The ones, you know, the ones you suspect of kind of being a little bit based. I'm not going to name them, actually. The ones you suspect, I'm not going to name them. Some of the Irish people. Keith Woods will know who I'm talking about if he's watching. She's a woman and she's Irish. But and various other people like that, trying to push them to the point where they speak to us, trying to break that taboo. Same way with the town, the asylum seeker towns, and getting them to kind of resist the media when they come down on them and say, no, I'm not racist. I don't mind them saying they're not racist. They can say, I'm not racist, but these people are okay, and they have their point of view, and I have the right to associate with who I want. Something like that, right? They need to be able to do that, these towns, and I desperately want the Galloways and these people to say, I'm an intellectual person, I'm a smart person, I have conversations, I will agree and disagree, but I will speak to these people. To break that barrier with Galloweans or whatever, people like that, would be massive. And it's definitely a thing written in the stars, I think, for the decade to come.
Yes, I hope so. Right now, there is a sort of tantric relationship between the dissident right, the alt-right, nationalists, and centrists. But it's a very thin one. I mean, it's not much of a connection, but it's there. And I hope that that is strengthened, but then also farther afield to the left. I hope that we build bridges there as well. And I think that It's not difficult. I mean, ultimately, if you care about, you know, on the left, they care about the poor, the needy, and so on. Well, you know, we could help the poor and needy. The native poor and needy, they don't benefit from having massive competition coming in from abroad to their jobs and their housing estates and so on. The foreign poor and needy, we can help them more effectively, more efficiently in their own countries. So that's one way that you could start trying to get through to the left. But I mean, that's just off the top of my head, and it might not even work. It's just an idea.
It's kind of like the anti-woke left, you know, and like some people have come out, these anti-woke left against immigration and all of these things. And to be honest, some of their arguments against immigration have been my arguments against immigration. I don't. And again, the more based among the chat can call me a cuck if they want to and all of this, right? But I don't. Again, I would rather talk about how immigration is landlord heroin, you know, in a sense. It's landlords and corporations and all of these things want this. The Tescos want people coming in the door buying their shit, right? And all of that. I personally would rather talk about that than talk about skull size. And I know I'm caricaturing things there. I know I'm unfairly caricaturing things, but you know what I mean. I just feel like there's a more relevant thing there, and it's easier to sell. And again, I've imagined the chat calling me things saying that. I'm not against certain queries and looking into things. If you confront me with them, I'm not going to cock out on them, whatever. But just some of these left-wing arguments against immigration, for example, the anti-woke left, like Galloway's one. If you look for the Galloway tweet on immigration recently, and he actually has been saying it for years, it's very powerful. And the thing is, it's impossible to deny. It's impossible to... I see you looking at the chat now, right? But it's impossible to argue with. And that's another thing I've been delighted with in the past year in Ireland. A lot of the people who've been, I won't use the word recruited, who've joined the kind of dissident right in Ireland have been politically engaged kind of old lefties. And at least those people care. At least they're not apathetic. And you would be amazed how quick they turn. Because once they get permission to, once they go, oh, that's cool. And they're also attracted to something in the dissident, the kind of targeted by the powerful. So it's very easy to bring those people over. And you know what? When they come over, they're great, generally great people. And they're very interesting and they bring interesting views with them.
Yeah. I think in general, it's just true that the left-right spectrum seems to be becoming, in some senses, just irrelevant, completely ruptured. What would you say?
So if you're on the right now, and that's the other thing, is the problem I have is the right, the free market right and all of that. I'm not saying anything original there. Go on the dissident right, American, British YouTube, they will all say it. But, you know, this whole thing of like the right has moved away from the free market stuff and the Zionism and all of that, right? And that's great. I deeply resent some of the nationalists in Ireland. I hope we can make common cause with them as we go forward. But, you know, they lost in the last couple of decades in Ireland by appealing to this kind of smarmy... Now I'm going to get in trouble with my own Irish people. The Catholic kind of Holy Joe thing, nothing against the religion thing, but just that kind of top-down authoritarian old Catholicism. Keith Woods had a term for it, actually. It's what's the word for it? I don't know. But that kind of thing, the Zionism, the free market disaster, we're moving away from that. That's clear at this point. And the anti-woke left are moving towards us on kind of immigration and stuff a little bit, right? And what they say is they don't like identity politics, or, you know, but we all know what that kind of means. They're moving towards us. So what are you left with? To kind of still use the old dichotomy, on the right, you have a lot of economic leftism, kind of, right? You have kind of immigration and hierarchy, a few of these things, common sense, or things that ordinary people agree with. And on the left, you have transgender children, open borders. What else is there? Oh, economic free marketism, because that inevitably goes with unicorn people. I mean, they might say they're leftist, but I push the economic right into the global liberalism now. So this left-right dichotomy is completely in our favor. It's so easy at this point. But again, it's about breaking those barriers. I don't think we want to be cloistered amongst each other forever. It would be nice to have engagement with some of these woke left people, and to just, it's so hard. It's such a nut to crack, but to just get some of those people to talk and transcend the corporate media, the state power and all of that. But once people begin to do it, people just need to grow a pair. I don't know how to do it, but it is going to happen, clearly.
Do you let's before we get to the questions, let's just go onto that matter. How do you foresee the next 10 years developing? Do you think what's the state of things going to be 10 years from now? The political situation in Ireland.
That's okay. There's a lot there. And of course, when I say there's a lot there, the real answer is I haven't a clue or whatever. But I do have my ideas. And the first thing to start with is I'm not a black pillar. You talked about this with Laura and many others. I just don't like the black pill. Think of the Spartans and whoever they were fighting with. That whole thing, it's like you don't go into a fight requiring preordained validation and victory in advance. That's pathetic, I just don't like that. So putting aside the black pill, and it would be easy to go there. I see states cracking down on us. I see Western governments abandoning liberalism. And when they do that, that's a paradigm shift. When they abandon their own liberalism, that is something we can exploit endlessly. We become actual dissidents in the classical sense, in the historical sense that we read about in textbooks and stuff. I don't know. I see a lot of pressure coming down on us as we go. I see us all being removed from tech platforms, but we're not going to go away. That's the thing. You're not going to go away, and people we're not going away. We're just going to show up on the street. You're going to have to hit us with truncheons if you must, or put us in jail. Where does that leave people? We have families, we have friends. They can't start arresting people en masse. I know they do it a bit already, but to do it bluntly, they will have to do that or let us continue doing what we're doing. We'll be choked off by tech platforms. Again, I think that could be somewhat, and because I don't like Blackpill, yes, that's really shit, but there's a positive aspect to that too. It gets us together. It gets us meeting in, our social media can become roads, houses, beaches, halls, maybe that's better in a sort of way. excuse me, sorry, I didn't mean to cough into the mic there. I've not been very well, but so I don't know. There's a lot of questions. A big thing I see is our ideology developing. So, your video about do we really connect to the past of 500 years ago? Right, that's a serious question. It's a very grave question, and it causes it's room for thinking, and it's a worrying question, and it's whatever. And the next question it leads to is, if not, then what? And that is the future. We need to build towards the future and appreciate that we are not going back, as Laura said, Renaissance paintings and stuff. We're not going back to LARP as, 17th century people, or even the 1950s. It is not going to happen. As Keith Woods like to talk about technology and economy and all that stuff is a beast of its own. We're going to have to, I think, somehow reconcile with that, somehow redirect it and deal with it, but we can't stop that tide. And I think our ideology is in its infancy. I think we need to think a lot harder, and we will as time goes on. With time comes thinking. So I think to come back in even 2 years' time, our ideology will be much, much different, as it has been in the last 2 years. But I think there's a long way to go. And I think when we do get to a coherent ideology, which is not denying the reality of the world and is coherent and is whatever, we'll be able to offer people a genuine alternative. Like that quote of, globalism.
I don't know what's happened there. I think he's lost. I'm sure Garrod will be back imminently. For now, just let me say that Orwell and Good has had to cancel tonight because of his internet connection is very bad, but he's saying that he might be able to make it tomorrow night, 2 hours before Morgoth, so that's 8 p.m. GMT. So, okay, please, I will, if you join my Telegram, follow my Telegram channel, MW Public, you'll be kept up to date with that, or you can just wait and see what comes up tomorrow. There is my channel on Telegram. You should be able to click on that and get it. Let's see what's happened now with Garrod. Okay. Okay. That's a shame because we were doing very well with Garrod. I just have to wait and see. I don't know what happened there. It must have been his internet connection. Or maybe he became a real dissident rather sooner than he was expecting. Maybe they've got him. I certainly hope not. Weird. I don't know what's happening here. Okay, he's saying chat and I'll be back. Well, I don't know what to chat about. Okay. Yeah, so Orwell does seem to be fairly confident that he can show up at 8 PM GMT tomorrow, just before Morgoth. So that's good. Can we have an impromptu AMA? Okay, I'll go through the questions that have been posted and see if there are any that I can answer. Okay. My wife and I met Garrod in Dublin recently. He's a gentleman and a great guest to have on Millennial. Glad to see him on here. I owe him a round or two. Cheers, lads. Thank you. Okay, I'll have to. Most of these are really for Garrod to answer. I can't. I also tell normies I don't want to be a minority, and I get the same response in liberal California. Toroidal Zeus, if you join Telegram and contact me there, I can probably put you in touch with Garrod. All right. Okay. Oh, I don't know what's going on. I think this is the first technical screw-up we've had, really, isn't it? What was that? Was there not another one with... was it on the offensive? He had to disappear for a few minutes. Have I ever been to Ireland? Yes, I was in Dublin in October 2017 for a conference there. And it was nice. It rained every day, and we went into the countryside and so on. Okay. Garrod says he's trying. He's trying to get back on. So yeah, I was there then, and I explored Dublin a bit. Not much, but I think I was there for about 5 days. And I was really sort of distracted by having to write the 1 hour from now speech for Erkenbrand, which was a week later. So I wasn't most relaxed, but I did have a lovely time there. I liked it. Of course, when you visit a place like that, you don't see what natives to it see. They see how much it's changed in 20 years, and they can remember what it was like and all that. When I arrived, you just see a nice old-fashioned, in terms of the architecture, European city. Of course, I shouldn't say European, Irish. It reminded me a lot of Edinburgh, actually, in terms of the style of the architecture. So, yeah, I think he is rebooting his computer. So the other time I was in Ireland was earlier this year, and I did a hike, not a terribly ambitious hike, but yeah, it was a hike. And I gave a speech, and it was recorded, and I've edited it, and it looks very nice. But I'm not sure if it's too hot for YouTube, so I don't know. It's one of the ones one of the 20 that I said I would try to get up before Millennial. I do apologize. I only managed to get... how many did I get? I think it was just the Hope Not Hate speech in the end. I think it was only one. But there was so much work that went into that. But they presumably will come in, be uploaded in January. Okay, Garrod is back. Excellent. All right. Welcome back.
About that. That was my Wi-Fi, I think. So, yeah. I don't know. I'm going to have to write an angry letter to them tomorrow, you know. Okay.
I can't remember what it was that you were saying when the interruption happened.
I can finish the thought very quickly because I think it had reached its conclusion anyway. I think developing our ideology a bit, basically that was it, like getting better, because I think we don't realize it, but we're probably in our infancy you know, stuff like kick the immigrants out and kick out the multinationals is not doable. Now, you could debate the immigrants thing and all that, but definitely on the economic scale, it's not doable. And like Keith Woods will tell you, you cannot separate economic liberalism and globalism from, or globalization. I know you make that distinction between globalization and globalism, but having globalization inevitably, to some extent, brings with it globalism. How do you manage that?
Right. Again, that's a very complex question. And it's like, this is our first encounter with globalization. So yes, it did. It did lead to globalism. This, like, globalism, globalization as a process, globalism as a mindset. So yes, in this case, it did, of course, lead to globalism. But I am saying my hope is that it doesn't have to. That, in other words, you can still care about your country and have a special love for your own country and your own people without approving of mass immigration and you know, global corporations getting massive tax cuts and controlling the politics in your country. They don't actually go hand in hand. They don't need to go hand in hand.
I agree they don't need to go hand in hand, but one of that, by developing ideology, I mean, you know, the question is how don't they need to go hand in hand in a kind of a detailed way? You know, like, if global corporations, who are the ones who make all of the money next to like national ones, right? If they make all the money and they are the ones who get to sponsor the media, who get to bribe the democratic governments and have all of that, then in a, you know, in a sense, I said earlier, we have a game theory advantage, but in a different sense, in a financial and a raw power sense, they have game theory advantage, and we're yet to see whose game theory is stronger. But that is going to be a perennial problem dealing with that power they will have and the ability to influence countries and all of this. You know, I was just thinking about it today in preparation for the stream. Like I kind of said, we have to reconcile, you know, you can't stop the tide, but you can redirect it. That was my kind of first analogy that came to mind. And I thought, well, how do you do that? Maybe you could put them into like city states, you know, like mini Singapores and countries and keep them separate, or create laws that they can't influence media. But how well can you create those laws? How do you do that? And then they can campaign against those laws versus you who has no money. So you're back to square one. And it's like, how do you do that? But the answer isn't we just kick them out or we get rid of multinationals. You can't do that at this point. We have to come up with an intelligent method to do this. And like, I personally look to countries, to go back to someone like Galloway, you look to countries like, you know, I think there's a lot to be learned from the likes of, and we might not politically align with them in many ways, but the Venezuelas and the Bolivias and the particularly Iran, maybe Russia, maybe China, you need to learn and observe and learn from these countries. How do they do it? And do they do it successfully? And if they do, how? To replicate those things. You know, that's a bit deeper than maybe just the immigrants and the multinationals. Getting into how we will have a state. And if you know, if you have it worked out a bit better, then you can probably sell that to people a bit better if it's more coherent. But yet it's not in denial of the world, you know, and how things must and will operate. I think that's just going to be a big thing we do. I mean, in a sense, I haven't really answered the question very artfully because that's kind of obvious. But I think it's worth noting.
As I said, this is our first encounter with globalization, and I think you could say it overwhelmed us. You could say that happened because of outside interests that ensured it happened. It doesn't really matter. The point is that I think we have to get better. I mean, okay, we're either going to reject globalization and return to the way things were, or we're going to get defeated by globalism, or we're going to, a third option would be to accept globalization, come up with our own globalism, one that does not destroy us. I think that's, in the simplest possible terms, those are the three options that we have lying ahead of us here.
I agree, pretty much. Nothing much to add.
Yeah. So it is, but as I say, we're just at the very start of this. This is the first time this has happened. It's a complete, massive, radical change from the way that we lived before, pre-globalization. It changed everything, more or less. And it's going to take some time to come up with a response to it, and of course, or a better way of dealing with it. And the main obstacle will be the people who are in control just now, which they will not want any change at all.
They're not going down without a fight. And like I said, with again, I'm not anti-nationalism in the Irish sense, the 32 counties thing and all that, right? No one can go calling me a unionist, right? But in this kind of nuanced division there is between the Irish nationalists of Sinn Féin and all of that versus them, us sucking away their energy and them coming to us, like I say, they are going to be like a cornered rat, I expect. And so will globalism 1.0, if we want to call it that. They're not, I mean, then you could say they're not going to go down without a fight. But I mean, what do you call what's happening now? A fight. They are fighting hard now. And we're back to the 30 million for that protest against, yeah, what, 200 of us?
It reminds me in The Matrix when, and I'm sorry, I hate to bring The Matrix into this, but it's an interesting, have you seen The Matrix?
Yes, yeah.
So there's that bit at the end where Keanu is fighting the agent, and the agent is having to fight it like at top speed, and Keanu is calmly, you know, just very slowly, nonchalant. That's a good analogy for the situation just now. The powers that be are having to invest massive amounts of money to combat us. Now, we are working hard, don't get me wrong, but we're doing it with very little money, very little resources. I think that has to be borne in mind, that just what they're having to do in order to even combat the tiny amount of power that we have already.
I think if anything is the takeaway from tonight, because there's a lot said and whatever, that could be maybe the one takeaway. You know, that single fact is reason to be excited for the next decade and the next year and the next month and the next week. But, you know, that's fun. That is fun to have an enemy like that. There's going to be loads happen like that. Again, the tech thing will be a thing. They will invest all that money against us. And I really enjoy, you know, you concentrate on immigration and all of these issues, but actually focusing more on the amount they put in. So that's what I do a lot of here in whatever small influence I have in Ireland, is to talk about the NGOs, government-funded activism, hammer that all the time. Just go, I don't even have an opposition. I don't have a sincere political opposition. You can't describe it as that. It's the government. It's the state at large, maybe you could say more broadly. So like this is, you kind of hand wave it away. You go, I don't worry about if they call me far right or far left or far up or down. That's just the government talking. I wouldn't worry too much about that, you know, and to just really concentrate on that and you know, and not just say it, but, you know, you can draw the lines of where that money goes through, and you can always find a link, as you can with Hope Not Hate and all of this, I'm sure. But that's a fun thing to do. And, you know, who knows, the right-wing George Soros, you know, or not the right-wing, but the nationalist George Soros, the based Soros might, you know, enter the stage at some point. We don't know what's going to happen. Also with events are going to occur, the main one being the recession that is going to come. There will be a recession, and the populism, I think, if we fight hard enough, and this is one of our big things, if we fight hard enough and play our cards right, populism could go largely our way. Or at least, if it won't go our way, we could hold them to a stalemate where the woke left join us. You know, that would be like us conceding we didn't win it, but at least we can, you know, that might be our opportunity to concede, but win also to, you know, to create this, like, okay, there's a woke left populism, there's us, and then there's the angry NGO, whatever's on the outside. And they go. So I think events, notably one we can predict, which is a recession, will go our way. So, you know, it's a lot of good stuff.
Sorry. Absolutely. I think this is a very interesting time. Somebody said, this is a very exciting time to live. We are living history. So, maybe that would be a nice line to end on. I forgot all the questions. Okay, we'll have to rattle through these questions. Do we really know that more traditional areas are being chosen for refugee centres? As I see it, they simply get spread out into any towns or cities rather than selecting little Gaelic hamlets.
Gaelic hamlets is a term I haven't heard yet, no, but that's a new one. Because hamlets is a distinctly kind of English word, isn't it? Yeah. It's just kind of funny. The Irish people will get that. But Gaelic hamlets. But yeah, these small Gaelic towns or Irish towns. I've thought about this or said this before. Is it a conspiracy in a room to target the Irish-speaking areas and all of this? Maybe not. But property prices are low there. It's the countryside. It's not Dublin. Property prices are low. Social capital is very high. You go to one of these Irish towns, they don't have huge companies or huge government investment. What they do have is massive community. Most of these communities have funds set aside, money that they can spend on stuff, collectively saved up, very tight-knit, very cohesive. So I think, and sports clubs, GAA is our national sport, right? We have clubs dotted all over the place, self-sustaining and everything. And we have these basically huge social capital in these towns, whereas if you sent them into Dublin or one of the cities, you would have to put, everything has to be a service. Everything has to be a paid-for state service. Whereas you put them into these places, high social capital, sports, this, that, you know, everything. And of course, people are very nice. People are very welcoming. People will bring you into the fold, which I don't think really happens with the asylum thing. But you know, they're basically, the government are preying on that. It's efficient to put them into these places. These places have no defense. They're not social, you know, they don't have media contacts, and largely property is low. So these cheap hotels that these disused hotels that don't really function anymore because of Airbnb, etc., these hotels are kind of abandoned. So, you know, you can put them in there. Whereas you don't have abandoned hotels in Dublin. In Dublin, they're building new hotels. So, you know, you could say they're trying to destroy the Irish language and the culture. Yeah, I suspect there is an element of that, but pragmatically speaking, everything points in doing that anyway, just at a pragmatic level. So the person there questioned whether it was true that they were doing that. They are doing that, but the question is for why. But either way, they're doing that. That is how it, the systematically how it ends up happening, regardless of the motive.
Yeah. Okay. I'll just move straight on to the next question. Is Garrod going to the protest against hate speech laws in Cork in January?
I'd need to know what date it is, but I'll try.
I can put you in touch with that questioner. Garrod, British and Irish patriots are already communicating. Let's put our past behind us and move forward together.
Let's reunify the entire Ireland of Ireland and put our differences aside. I say that rhetorically because someone else would say, well, let's leave the North as part of the UK because that's where it belongs. Someone might say that. And, you know, the differences, some of the differences are kind of fundamental. And again, it's not my, I'm not obsessed with this stuff at all, but just the differences of the North of Ireland is an old conflict. I don't think there's any pretending, and nobody pretends, that is not a kind of intractable thing and it's problematic. It is intractable because usually with a political dispute, it's like Israel-Palestine or something. Actually, no, it's not like that. That's more solvable. But, you know, it's when you see a political thing that there is no actual logical answer, it's difficult. So the differences are whatever in the North. But, I mean, if you're asking me to put our differences aside because I have some animosity towards British people, I mean, I don't think, I don't, and none of the nationalists I know have any kind of hang up or of any sort. So putting the differences aside is kind of maybe more or less a moot point if you're talking to me.
Okay. The hate speech rally or anti-hate speech, whatever it is, it's on the 4th of January, apparently.
So, cool.
Okay.
I'll try.
All right. Garrod, do you know if there was a vote in the direct provision centre in Ennis, like there was in Liston Farna? Not much info about it on the internet.
That's a bit of an inside thing for those who are watching who aren't Irish. It's another town that's had one, an asylum centre going on. Again, these guys, I think this one was all men, probably African or maybe Georgian. I don't know. Our biggest asylum population is Georgian, which is hilarious because, you know, there's nothing going on there. But in Ennis, I don't think there was a vote because, just to answer the questioner, I don't think there was a vote because I don't think there was a town meeting organised for there, so I don't know. But you can be sure the vote would be 97% against, as it was in Uachtaráid.
Right. Okay. This is a thorny question. Given the history between Britain and Ireland, how welcome is support from British nationalists, and what can we do to support each other to what seems to me to be a common cause?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the difference between Ireland and England, I'm not concerned about that. Like, it's a new time. We're in a different stage. Yeah. Also, like, you know, the this is just one way of looking at it. I'm not a historical expert, but it's just a kind of a, let's say, a narrative, is that in 1916, when the Irish rising happened and all of that against the Empire, you know, that wasn't, and it's important for people to know, British or otherwise, that wasn't an idea of that we want different pigmentation on our flag and we want different designs or something, you know, that kind of, that would be petty nationalism. There's, it's colors, it's stupid things like that. No, it's not. It's, it was to do with history of, I suppose, colonial oppression. But more importantly, I think, is that Britain, the British Empire at that point, which had its, you know, heyday and all of that, to some extent, it was a liberal empire. It was an empirical British liberal merchant empire.
And
The ordinary British person in Yorkshire working a farm or whatever, do they have much to do with that? No, of course not. So, you know, you read some of the works of these 1916 nationalists, and I'm sure Keith Woods talks about this a bit, but, you know, so you might have heard it, but like, they weren't talking about pigmentation on a flag. They were talking about the education system and liberalism and all of this. It was an anti-liberal movement. It was for territorial independence, but it was also ideological. It was against the idea of global whatever. And you could say an empire in its kind of late stage, its kind of merchant stage, is kind of like a global merchant liberal empire, as Britain was at the time. It's not an offensive thing or anything. Because, again, the key point here is that it didn't really apply to British people. It was this whole massive, like America now. America has its global empire in Afghanistan and everywhere, and Germany and Poland. Does the average guy in Kansas have anything to do with that? Not really. And again, I'm not like throwing shade at the, I know Laura mentioned, I know British people have a pride in the empire, and they're right to, and from their perspective, but just that was then and this is now. And even then it wasn't against British people. So there isn't like British nationalists versus us. There's some personal animosity, like, you know, Manchester United versus Liverpool. I think that's a simplistic way to look at it. And it's not like that, you know?
Yeah. I think that a very short answer to the question, how can we support each other? Given our history, is we can support each other. I mean, it's as simple as that. The past really just doesn't need to come into this.
Yeah, that was a much more succinct answer. Yeah, it does. It's, the question kind of answers itself. How can we support each other? We can support each other.
Yeah. Okay. Do NGOs ever work locally, or are they mostly abroad and international? I think you've answered that.
Did he say abroad? Or he or she? Yeah. Broad. There are things called public participation networks, which are these kind of, again, sorry for the foreign viewers, it's not relevant to you, but public participation networks, which are a kind of they're established in each locality, and they're meant to be ostensibly a thing where local communities can contact their PPN and say, this is what we're interested in. It's kind of a microphone towards the government. But what I've discovered is what it really is for the government, when they want to implement their plans, the PPN work in the opposite direction. They arrange things for the government. So it kind of goes in that way, and largely are related to and organize NGOs. So,
yeah. Okay. Someone asks, and this is a very random question, but I think you might have an opinion on it. Should we bring back dueling?
Should we bring back dueling? Okay. Debate dueling. If you're talking about facts and logic, then yes.
I don't think you are. Yeah. A feeling he actually meant swords and you know, two guns.
I mean, I don't know the exact of it, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, okay. Someone says, economic arguments against immigration have been tried, but they have failed. It's not enough. I think he's making the point that it has to be about identity and heritage and all that.
It can be about both. I mean, again, I like to be Mr. Nuance. Like, I don't see why it can't be both. I may have argued in favor of the economic thing versus the identity thing, but if someone came to me saying that it needs to be all economic, I would invoke the idea that identity is, of course, important as well. And I don't know, you would need to tell me where economic arguments against immigration have. I suppose they have failed. I see his point. Yeah.
Yeah.
It needs to be both.
Yeah, I think so. Do you support Justin Barrett?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, isn't there a big bipartisan culture of corruption in Northern Ireland due to decades of subsidies from London?
I'm not an expert. Northern Ireland is its own. You would need to do a PhD and live there for 20 years and all of this to understand it. It's complicated. There's so much going on. The person who asked probably knows more than I do.
Right. Okay. If a bunch of us donated, would you pay a sum of money to a prominent Irish media hack to debate you on immigration, demographics, and corruption?
Absolutely. Yes. They wouldn't say yes, though. And I'm not trying to say I'm a Ben Shapiro here, but they wouldn't say yes. Like,
It would be a funny thing to do, though, wouldn't it? A way to go about it, to sort of attempt to like offer them €1,000 to do this.
For charity.
For a charity. And yet they still won't do it. I think that would speak wonders. And of course, you could just roll over into the next one. You could keep doing it. So 2,000 to someone else.
There was an economist from Trinity College Dublin, which is like the kind of college in Ireland. And he was trying to say, he tried to take on the dissident right in Ireland on Twitter, on housing and demand and all of this stuff. And he eventually got brought to this kind of point where he was saying immigration doesn't add to demand for housing per se. It just creates more need for supply. This kind of stuff, like these, subhuman answers. It would be fun. Go for it. I'll do that.
Somebody in the chat is saying, interview Justin Barrett, millennial. Well, I would if I knew how to get in touch and he was amenable to it. But I don't know. It's not. You got to be careful with this stuff for obvious strategic reasons. But I'm open to talk, and to Gemma O'Doherty as well. Somebody else suggested that earlier on. Okay. Neither of my parents is Irish, and I am half East Asian, but my teachers always told me that I was Irish. Immigrant kids are also wronged by the system because we get lied to.
So neither parents are Irish. He's half East Asian, or he or she. I would love to know what the other half is, just out of curiosity, while we're going into it. But anyway, was told by his teachers that he is Irish. See, again, I could appeal to the kind of more alt-right side here on the chat, and we have an international audience, and I could try to kind of pander, but I'll be honest. I don't think people can come here en masse, hundreds of thousands, and all be Irish, right? You need only go down in Dublin to, certain streets, certain neighborhoods, Balbriggan, people will know that, all of these things. There's nobody, a lot of the people there who aren't ethnically Irish, they're also not Irish in any other way, right? Because it's in numbers and all of this stuff. But then again, there was a guy, and again, this name will sound strange to you, but a guy called Sean O'Halpin, right? And these are the kind of arguments that lefties in Ireland will trot out. And I kind of agree with him a little bit. There was this guy, he became a hurler, which is our kind of national sport in Ireland. He was half Irish, half Fijian, I think. He came to Ireland. He was born and raised there like 40 years ago. He won double county championships. He was a hero and all of this, right? Spoke Irish, all of that. Like a model example a lefty could bring up. Now, if you present that guy to me and go, is he Irish? Does he get to be Irish? I will say, yes, he does. Yeah. For one, he's half Irish anyway, if you want to get into blood and all this stuff. But that applies, I don't even know what that person's question was exactly. But again, these things are nuanced. You know what I mean? I can't commit to the whole idea that you have to have a 23andMe test. And that you can't, as someone who is completely not Irish blood-wise, adopt some of that stuff and cherish it in small numbers back in the day. It doesn't really happen anymore. It's nuanced. But, if that person is watching this stream right now, and I don't know, what am I supposed to say to them? Get out, leave, you're not Irish. Whatever. What was the question, actually, at the end?
Well, at the end of that. That he was lied to by his teachers, who told him that he was Irish when he's not on either side.
It's like in a way you're Irish, in a way you're not Irish. To me, it's that simple. I don't know. It's instinctual to understand the kind of nuance there, to me, without getting too spurgy on the precise definition. It's like, yes, in a way you're Irish, in a way you're not Irish, and that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of what I said earlier with Laura Tyler. Okay, how should we handle the pseudo-Republican lie that being a right-wing Irish nationalist is basically synonymous with being pro-British?
Pseudo-Republican lie that being an Irish nationalist is synonymous with being pro-British. To me, that doesn't make sense. Maybe I'm late in the night. Because the question that would make sense is to say, how do we get over the idea that being an Irish Republican is synonymous with being anti-British? That would kind of make sense. And I could answer that question, but I don't know how to. Yeah.
Well, go for it.
Well, to be an Irish Republican is not to be. It might not necessarily involve being anti-British, but it definitely doesn't involve being pro-British. It's kind of a contradiction of terms. I don't know. I don't, you know, whatever. But I think that question might be phrased difficultly.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Okay, what do you think of Ireland joining a hypothetical Anglosphere union with other English-speaking countries as an alternative to the EU? Such a union would bring us closer to our own Irish diaspora.
I mean, there's this history of not wanting to swear an oath to the Queen and be in the Commonwealth and the whole slew of things, so that would be offensive to our history and stuff. But, I mean, it's kind of neither here nor there, which is a rude way to answer a question. But, I mean, to join an Anglosphere, I mean, that would involve us, the UK, Canada, Australia. I mean, I have no problem with that. But, like, I mean, you know, I'm not going to be signing any bills on it, like, or anything. So, right. You know. But yeah.
Okay. Are you aware of Irish YouTuber Dave Cullen of Computing Forever?
Yeah, I'm very aware of him because, first off, I've met him at a few of the rallies and he's got, what, 500, somewhere around 500,000 subs on YouTube. Massive big deal and all that. But he is attending these free speech rallies, which is amazing. And like 2 weeks ago, my channel has been kind of scatty. And so I don't have many subscribers. I don't worry about it too much. But he gave me a shout out, and I got, so just in case he's watching here, I must have gotten 1,000 subscribers from that alone, because I saw it happen after he mentioned me. And that's a very, very nice thing to do. He shows up to the rallies, so he could just talk about, and he has his own things. He talks about the PC element in the new Star Wars and all of these things, and that's good. He's got an audience for that, and that's very worth talking about for people who are into that stuff. But he isn't just detached from his national situation, which is my argument for this whole video, you know, get back to where what you can do locally as well. So, and that's easy to say for me with a few thousand subscribers. He's got 500,000 and he still does it. So huge respect for him.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think they'll make the public vote again on the 2004 referendum on birthright citizenship?
Absolutely, yeah, sooner or later, yeah. So in 2004, just for those who don't know, there was a referendum on citizenship because of the Good Friday Agreement, the agreement in the North to end conflict. Part of that, kind of through one legal mechanism or another, made it so that Irish citizenship was, we had birthright citizenship, which we kind of hadn't before, but as part of the Good Friday Agreement, it became a thing somehow, I don't know why, but it did. And then the nurses in the hospital started freaking out and begging the government to take action on this because we had endless amounts of African people and others coming here to give birth and become citizens. And it was, even for a country that was global liberal, it was too much. It was too much. The country and the hospitals were being overwhelmed. Midwives and nurses begged for it. We got a referendum and it was one of the largest mandates in Irish referendum history to say, yes, we will remove birthright citizenship. We don't want that, which is a huge mandate. Only how many years ago? 15 years ago. And they're already beginning the dialogue in the media on, well, we need to look at that again and have another one. So.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay. The guy asks, he's rewording the question from earlier. Left-wing Republicans say that people who oppose immigration are as bad as the British. How do we show that we right-wing nationalists are from a truly Irish nationalist tradition?
So that we're as bad as the British. First off, I reject that premise anyway, because it's like, what? How bad do you have to be the British? I don't agree with that. I don't think the British are the marker for how bad you can possibly be, for one, anyway. But maybe left-wing Republicans use that framework. I would say you look at James Connolly, you look at Padraig Pearce. These are all, you know, heroes in Irish independence history. Padraig Pearce was very right-wing, we'll say. There's a word for it, but anyway. W.B. Yeats, some of the spiritual or poetic leaders, they had their views. And James Connolly, who was a left-wing socialist in Ireland, he was one of the fathers of trade unionism, was against immigration, as was Karl Marx. So basically, you look to any Irish Republican hero and they're on our side, not the other side. So that's all you need to do, I think.
Right, okay. Two questions that aren't really for you. One of them is to me and the other is an insult to me. So I'll read them out and then we'll wrap up. MW, do you think that having a large audience of Americans causes you to alienate normie Brits by discussing white nationalism too much as opposed to British nationalism. As Garrod says, white nationalism is a gross idea to British normies. Yes and no. I think you're probably right that at a certain point I got too carried away with the alt-righty sort of terminology, like 2017, early 2018. I think you're right, but not. I don't think it's a terminal problem, put it that way. And as I said earlier in the discussion with Garrod, I do think there is truth to, I mean, the concept of white. I think it is a legitimate concept, a legitimate category. So, and sometimes it's strategically useful in debate, as I illustrated. So, yeah, it's one of these, again, very nuanced points. But as for whether I'm alienating people, I hope not. I certainly wouldn't want to do that. And then the other one, which is an insult, this comes from Lou Duva, who was, again, a bit aggressive in the live chat, and one of my mods put him on timeout. He says to me, "Woz, you're a faggot for fucking with me in the way that you have been. Censoring supporters for criticising your guests is pathetic. I'll no longer be listening to your shite. Fuck yourself."
That's good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it can get quite heated in the live chat. Lou, calm down. Look, what else am I supposed to do? I can either do that or I can ban you, or I can leave you to insult my guests. And I'm not going to do that because I think that guests should be treated with respect. All right? It's not that they can't take criticism. Of course they can, but there's a way to do it. So as for no longer listening to my shite, I think that you'd be quite disappointed by that, because tomorrow or very soon I'm going to do that stream that you asked me to do. So, you know, I hope that you do remain subscribed. All right. So any final thoughts about what we've been talking about to wrap it up in a nice, tidy, white pilly or Irish pilly sort of way?
Green pill. The green pill is, I don't know, whatever we have to offer as a country. Again, I've learned a lot from other countries, and we will make our mistakes and you will learn from those elsewhere. So it's not, you know, it's whatever, but we do have a history of this kind of revolutionary stuff that we can take from, and other countries have their things, Britain and America and everything. But like I say, we all need to act locally. It's like that phrase. Do you know the one? Maybe you can say it for me. Act locally. Think globally, right? Yeah. Yes. Think in terms of globally being your, like, you know, if you're for open civilization, right? And all that. I don't mean to take the piss, but like, you know, think like that, but act locally. And you know, as we've touched on, there's a lot to look forward to in this next decade. I think we're going to move forward a lot, and the main thing is have fun and enjoy it, and we have the game theory advantage. That's about it for me.
Excellent. I think we've got lots of advantages as outlined in this discussion. So it's gone on quite a long time, but I think it's been a really useful, interesting and enjoyable discussion. I think a lot of the chat would agree. So all right, thank you very much, Garrod Murphy, and I hope that this gets you some more subscribers. So, as I said earlier, Orwell and Good has had to cancel because of his internet connection. So I will be back tomorrow, hopefully at 8 p.m. with Orwell and Good. If not, then at 10 p.m. with Morgoth. And that will be the end of Millennial 2019. So it'll be quite emotional for some of us. In the meantime, I really enjoyed this one with Garrod. So thank you very much, Garrod, for taking part in Millennial 2019. All right. And thank you to everyone for watching, and I will see you tomorrow night. Bye-bye for now.